Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is Timothy Gordon. He's the author of a new book called Catholic Republic. And Timothy, just so you know, this is an evangelical program, but it's interesting to get different perspectives. And we're going to talk about some ways in which Catholic thought helped create the United States of America. And by the way, Timothy's book called Catholic Republic is available at sophiainstitute.com. Timothy, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks a million. It's great to be here. I really mean that. You know why.
Okay, great. Well, tell us about your book. What is the overall thesis?
The overall thesis of Catholic Republic is that America is a nation that's been wired Catholic, labeled Protestant, and is currently functioning secular. And the centerpiece of this thesis is the natural law, the Aristotelian and Thomistic natural law. That means the tradition coming from Aristotle, the pagan Greek, as channeled through some thinkers leading to Thomas Aquinas, the scholastic, medieval thinker. This gives us the sense of natural law, which is indispensable to documents like the Declaration of Independence, articulating natural right, which is a function of natural law. Documents like the Constitution, which articulates localism, or what in the Catholic intellectual tradition is called subsidiarity, a very old concept. And then cultural concepts that are necessary for the culture, the people of America, like virtue ethics. The thesis is that even though America was peopled by, exclusively almost by, Protestant thinkers and some kind of secular leaning Enlightenment thinkers, both of these constituent camps, the Reformation Puritans, on the right-hand side, who love Jesus, and the secular left thinkers that kind of hailed from the Enlightenment camp, who didn't love Jesus, both of them kind of acknowledged that if they were going to make recourse to the natural law in documents like the Declaration of the Constitution or any of its goodies, like natural rights or subsidiarity, they would have to do so against their own prevailing worldview. They would have to do so in contravenience of either their Protestantism or their Enlightenment thought. And when I looked to write the book, the sources proved to utterly bear this out, which is why it's wired Catholic, labeled Protestant, and the currently functioning secular.
Well, okay, there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, you say that from the reform perspective, that would be a contradiction to think in terms of natural law, and yet I know for a fact, here are the four most widely sources quoted by the Founding Fathers. The Bible itself, of course, okay, number one. But number two, as far as human writers, Baron Montesquieu, who was a Catholic thinker in France. And then the second most quoted human being was Sir William Blackstone, who definitely would be Protestant, and then also John Locke, third. By the way, William Blackstone gives as good a definition, I think, of what, of natural law. But I think, don't Protestants sign on to the whole idea of natural law? Let's back up. What is natural law? And how is it, uniquely, let's say, Thomistic, and how is it that, say, somebody like Sir William Blackstone wouldn't agree with it, which I think he absolutely does. I think he articulates natural law as well as just about anybody.
Perfect. Well, it's a highly equivocal term. So we have to define exactly what we mean. By the way, Montesquieu was a natural law thinker. He was really, really important for the framing period in the late 1780s. He was the most important thinker for the framing of the Constitution. Yeah. The founding period is the late 1770s, which is the period of the Declaration, and Locke and Blackstone were more important for the founding. Montesquieu was dire for the framing. So yeah, that's all right when you merge that entire 15-year period or so. Well, yeah, so natural law, and Montesquieu was a natural law thinker. But you're exactly right. Let's give the natural law some teeth so that we have something to measure against. I give it in three prongs, right? Nature as, colon, and then three bullet points. You have to affirm each of these three bullet points to pass muster as any kind of a bona fide natural law thinker, because lots of traditions use the term, including Locke and Blackstone and other Whigs like Algernon Sidney. So first off, to be a natural law thinker, you have to see nature as a place of moral freedom, meaning you can't believe that the human will is in bondage, in either a theological or a practical sense, which is why whether you're talking, you know, Luther or Calvin or even Melanchthon or any of that, it's sort of, you know, it's basically a bust. You have to believe that nature, even though it's not an inherently good place after the fall of Adam and Eve, right? You have to believe that man still is not predestined or anything like that, predetermined only to sin. You have to believe that virtue is a possibility. And Luther rejected the writings of Aristotle on precisely this ground. And same thing with he rejected the scholastic thinkers. On the other hand, so this is the interesting sort of triangulation that happens. Protestant thinkers I'll show how, or I'll argue how at least, will reject each of these three prongs. This is prong one. From the Christian perspective, and the Enlightenment thinkers will reject each of those three prongs of the natural law from the anti-Christian perspective. Protestants are basically, the founding Protestants are basically the grandparents of what we call the religious right today. The Enlightenment framers and founders were the grandparents of what we call the secular left, but they agree as to a kind of schizophrenic rejection of the natural law. The Enlightenment thinkers will reject prong one, nature as a place of moral freedom, because they believe we're just animals or glorified meat machines. We don't talk about chimpanzees or lions as enjoying moral freedom because they don't have it. Chimpanzees might have large brains, but they don't have intellect, which is one of the two constituent parts of the soul. So, prong two, I argue rejected by both sides for varying reasons, is you must see nature as a place of intelligibility, meaning you can learn from and about your surroundings. We don't just mean in the crass sensory context of being able to like see. Obviously, even a lion or a chimpanzee can do that. You must be able to learn, abstract, be able to do things like mathematics, which is utterly abstract, and might even be able to make claims about what we would call, out of the Aristotomist tradition, natural theology. Learn about certain aspects, certain limited aspects about the creator from creation. Of course, this is a major no-no in the Protestant tradition, where this is viewed almost, you know, very skeptically, almost as a form of paganism.
I have to wait. Let me jump in here. When I look at, again, Sir William Blackstone, and you read what he's saying, he's basically saying the creator has impressed on his creation, and virtually every cell and so forth. He didn't use that word, but I did. But in every part of his creation, his will, and he basically says that there's two variations of this will. There's first what he has revealed in nature itself, natural law, and then what was missing there, essentially because of the fall, he revealed in the scriptures. And then he says no human laws should contradict either of those two revelations from God. I mean, to me,
sure.
Again, this is Protestant thought, but it's, Protestantism in some ways is the other side of the coin of the Roman Catholic Church, you know, as opposed to, there's a lot of, I mean, Protestants are Trinitarian affirming, I mean, generally, in fact, those Protestants that don't affirm the Trinity Protestants themselves would have viewed, you know, by and large, as heretics, etc. So there's a lot of ways in which Protestantism and Catholicism agree, and a lot of these basics are found, you know, in the creation of America.
Of course, but definitely. I mean, we have all these things codified. Now the Protestant tradition is less, you know, it's not magisterial, so there's, you know, the definitions are more moving, but sure, the reason, for the record, that a Protestant is a bona fide Christian is because of the Trinitarian baptism, which does not need to be done even in the Catholic Church by a priest. So if a Protestant converts to Catholicism, his baptism, as long as it was done in the name of the Trinity, and this is a believer in the Trinity, will not be repeated, right? He'll just, that Protestant, if he's of age, will then just make his first confession, communion, all that. We wouldn't repeat it because it's a valid, it's, you know, what we would acknowledge as the one valid sacrament. But now, belief in error, basically the Aristotelian natural law is not one of the points of overlap. One need only consult the writings of Luther on this, or just the nominalistic tradition, the school of nominalism at Erfurt, where Luther studied for 11 years before entering the monastery, to understand that nominalism and the voluntarism, these are kind of $10 words to describe a few of the things that all the 40,000 sects of Protestants share in common. It might be a kind of form of the natural law, but even eminent Lutheran scholars will acknowledge it's a kind of a mitigated form of natural law that does conform to the dictates of nominalism and voluntarism. They don't accept the Aristotelmist natural law because
okay, huh? Well,
the demands of sola scriptura and sola fide don't allow natural law in its full Aristotelian form. The limits on knowledge are much more strict when you talk about sola scriptura. That's a big claim, sola.
All right. Well, we have about 2 minutes left. Let's just kind of try and understand. Okay, when the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal, are endowed by their Creator. Certain unalienable rights. Life, that's straightforward. Liberty, that's straightforward. The pursuit of happiness, what does that mean? And what does that mean religiously even?
Pursuit of happiness is, from the Aristotomist tradition, is actually a redundant way of saying liberty, because there's a difference between liberty, which is ordered freedom, eudaimonian freedom, freedom to pursue the good. There's still a constraint on that sort of freedom. It's duty and the good. And license, which is actually its opposite, which is a non-ordered kind of freedom, the root of the word licentiousness. So modern-day liberty is taken to be license, and I argue kind of why that happened is because America's founders were guarding their reading list. But let me give you one final sort of analogy. Imagine you and I are in a Catholic and a Protestant. Well, imagine we're in a burning building and we're going to have to make a leap out the window to an adjacent building, a floor below, for whatever reason. Forget the natural law. I would argue that of the 56 signers of the Declaration, there was only one Catholic signer, Charles Carrollton. They all believed in the natural law, but only one of them had the sort of constituent philosophy to believe in it, right? That would be Charles Carroll. So I'm not saying that the other 55 denied it, or really even as far as they knew attempted to deny it. It would be like if me and you had to make this leap from the burning building to the floor below. Let's say I had made a career out of denying the existence of gravity. Let's say you like everyone else, you did not deny the existence of gravity. Well, we both make the leap. Praise be to God, we both make it. We calculate our parabolas, we make the jump, we land on the balcony, and we're saved. God is good. But you might be tempted to gloat a little bit and say, hey, so how's that no gravity turning out for you? You know, how's that working out for you? Because you just used a parabola, which is a function of falling bodies, with an X component of motion, to use gravity, even though you've made a career sort of denying it. That's the position of the 55 other signers of the Declaration, according to my argument, with regard to the natural law, meaning life, liberty, property, pursuit of happiness, and even the constitutional concept of localism, subsidiarity. These are all natural law precepts from a worldview which is sort of in its backwards, in an arcane way, attempted to deny the natural law. That's what I mean. The founding and framing of America are not Catholic so much as they're crypto-Catholic because of the covered reading list.
All right, we're basically out of time. SophiaInstitute.com for more information. The book, again, is called Catholic Republic. The author, Timothy Gordon. Thank you, Timothy, for being with us. All the best.
Thanks a million.
Okay, great. Thanks. Bye-bye.